Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. It is not unusual to see people swimming in the height of summer in Seattle, Washington. But this is autumn. The salt water of Puget Sound is 13 degrees Celsius, and the air is not much warmer. That is why you can hear the involuntary sounds at the start of a group swim. 43-year-old Mike Tanner enters the water first. He works with technology and lives near Seattle. At a time when other people might go to Hawaii or Mexico, he chooses chilly Puget Sound.
You know, I usually swim from about May until end of November in open water, and then I go back to the pool again and wait for May again.
Mike Tanner jokes that he is not very intelligent. He says swimming in open water is a challenge for him. He also says he gets bored in a pool. He wants something a little more exciting. On this day, Mr. Tanner has paid to join a guided group called a swim excursion. Most of the people wear wetsuits to cover more of their bodies than traditional swimsuits. More than 10 swimmers are in the group. They follow an orange kayak for a 1.5-kilometer saltwater swim. Gila Muir paddles the first of the support boats.
A swim excursion is not a race. That's the primary differentiation. It's an expedition. It's an adventure.
Gila Muir has turned the idea into a business called Say Yes to Life Swims. She began swimming a lot after her 40th birthday. The Seattle businesswoman soon recognized there were enough other enthusiastic swimmers around to support her company. She questions why anyone would pay to swim in a community pool.
Why pay to swim when you can just go down and jump in yourself? It's for the camaraderie, as you can see, the incredible enthusiasm, the feeling of support.
She spoke during a stop at a beach. There, the group gathered around a small fire to warm up after their swim. They ate fish and chips and drank hot chocolate. The establishment of Ms. Muir's business 3 years ago shows the increased interest in open water swimming in the Northwest United States. Kelly Reynolds of Seattle is one of the newest converts to the sport. She says she swam in college 2 years ago, but she does not want to race in swimming pools anymore. She says she does not want to see how slow she is. You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. Recently, a government official said young Taiwanese are more likely to want a safe job than show an interest in starting a business. This way of thinking is different from their parents' generation and modern mainland Chinese. Marcia James has more.
In October, a Taiwan negotiator to China warned that Taiwanese lacked what he called aggressiveness and an enterprising spirit. He warned against being a sheep following others in the face of fast-growing China. The rarely heard criticism by a public official points to growing concern in Taiwan that young people are more likely to prefer a safe job to starting their own business. This way of thinking is different from that of their parents and modern mainland Chinese. This preference for safe jobs threatens new business startups on the island. Officials say such businesses are important for Taiwan's future as an exporter of goods from plastics to electronic products. Officials want Taiwanese to keep inventing and investing so they can remain competitive against other areas. Yanlin Fu is a publisher of books on Taiwanese history. He says parents in Taiwan guide their adult children to look for safe jobs and schools and provide little motivation. He says young Taiwanese people care most about the quality of life. He adds that this preference relates to history and that modern parents want their children to lead a safe life after college. Yanlin Fu calls Taiwan's education system peaceful. He says there is no pressure for students who study hard. But young people in mainland China are pushed harder to compete. The reason? Their parents and schools. Tony Fu is an economist in Taipei. He says Taiwan now risks being surpassed by China. China is already a less costly manufacturing base and a larger consumer market. World Bank reports show that Chinese high technology exports have risen from 5% to 26% of exports since the 1990s. In Taiwan, the number of people taking the civil service test for first-time government jobs nearly doubled between 2002 and 2012. About 0.5% of those who took the first exam last year were offered employment. Younger Taiwanese and their parents consider government jobs among the island's most secure. Fear of risk has also appeared in Taiwan's prized high-tech industry. Jay Yin is deputy director with the Market Intelligence and Consulting Institute in Taipei. He says younger people fear the cost of starting a business. He says younger Taiwanese are not bad at inventing things, but he says there are fewer young people interested in launching businesses because of the risk they must take. He says most people work for large information technology companies. Jay Yin calls this a cultural problem and says people are conservative. He notes that starting a company could take years. He says one does not know in the beginning how long it will take to earn a profit. His group found that Taiwanese high-tech inventors were more interested in starting businesses around 2000, when internet use was growing. It says there was a pullback as industry competition intensified. I'm Marcia James.
And that's our program for today. Join us tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
from VOA Learning English. This is In the News. President Barack Obama is making preparations for a week-long trip to Asia and Australia. The president arrives in Beijing on Monday. During his visit, Mr. Obama plans to meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping. He also will attend the yearly meetings of APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum. On Wednesday, Mr. Obama goes to Myanmar for the East Asia Summit and a meeting of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. The trip ends at the Group of 20 talks in Brisbane, Australia. North Korea is not a member of either APEC or ASEAN, but its nuclear activities are sure to be discussed at these meetings. Kim Han-kwon is with the Asan Institute for Policy Studies in Seoul. He says the issue of North Korea is not just a subject for the Korean Peninsula and East Asia, but one that can bring a big change in the security system of Asia and the Pacific. So, he says, related countries will hold discussions either officially or unofficially at the meetings. This week, South Korean media reported that North Korea has opened a new uranium enrichment center at its main nuclear area. Some observers believe North Korea has made progress in its effort to build an atomic bomb. But the North is still believed to be working on a way to make a nuclear weapon smaller. In recent years, observers thought the North Korean nuclear issue would be one in which the United States and China could cooperate to reduce tensions. China reportedly became angry with North Korea after the North carried out a nuclear test in 2013. The test was a violation of United Nations resolutions. But China has shown little interest in supporting strong sanctions against North Korea. Chinese officials fear such measures could threaten security in the country. President Obama is to meet with South Korean President Park Geun-hye in Myanmar, also known as Burma. They will likely discuss recent signals coming from Pyongyang. The North Korean government has, at times, showed an interest in restarting international talks on its nuclear program. But the North continues to send hostile signals toward both South Korea and the United States. The leaders of China, Russia, and India are also expected in Myanmar's capital for the ASEAN meetings. But observers have limited expectations for the talks. The ASEAN way of compromise and non-intervention has helped keep Southeast Asia at peace for years. And that is the only effective way for the group to operate. So says Rodolfo Severino of the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies in Singapore. He spoke to VOA on Skype.
No, ASEAN is not about breakthroughs. ASEAN works on an incremental basis.
The talks are to lead the launch of the ASEAN Economic Community next year. The AEC is supposed to help increase cross-border trade and travel. And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz.
Now the special English program, American Stories. And our story today is called Judge. It was written by Walter D. Edmonds. Here is Harry Monroe with the final part of our story.
When Charlie Haskell died, he left a wife and 9 children. They lived on a small piece of land in a house with 4 rooms. Since John was the oldest boy, his mother told him he would have to take care of the family. He was 16. John went to Judge Doan, the richest man in town, to collect a dollar for some corn the judge bought from John's father. Judge Doan gave him the dollar. Then he said John's father owed him some money. He said the farmer had borrowed $40 from him. "When do you think you will pay me back the money you owe me?" the judge asked John. "I hope you are not like your father," he said. "He was a lazy man who never worked hard." During that summer, John worked on other people's farms all week. He worked on his own family's land every evening and all day Sunday. By the end of the summer, John had saved $5 to give to the judge. John's friend, the Indian Seth Whitefeather, offered John a way to make money during the winter, when it was too cold for farming. He said he would teach John how to hunt and trap animals for their fur. He told the boy he could earn a lot of money by doing this, but he said John needed $75 to buy a gun, traps, and food for a winter in the woods. John went to see Judge Doan. He explained what he wanted to do. The judge agreed to lend him the money he needed. On the first day of November, John kissed his mother goodbye and left home with Seth. On his back, he carried a large sack of food, a new gun, and animal traps he had bought with the judge's money. He and the Indian walked for hours to a cabin deep in the forest. Seth had built the little house several years before. John learned a lot that winter. He learned how to hunt and set traps for wild animals and how to live in the forest. His body grew strong as the forest tested his strength and made him brave. John trapped a lot of animals. In early March, his pile of animal skins was almost as tall as he was. Seth said John should get at least $200 for his furs. John was ready to go home, but Seth wanted to continue hunting until April. So John decided to go home by himself. Seth helped John pack his furs and traps so he could carry them on his back. Then Seth said, "Now listen to me. When you cross the river, do not walk on the ice. It is very thin now. Find a place where the ice has melted. Then tie some logs together. You can float on them across the river. It will take you a few hours longer to do this, but it is safer." "Yes, I will," John said quickly. He wanted to leave right away. As John walked through the woods that day, he began thinking about his future. He would learn how to read and write. He would buy a bigger farm for his family. Maybe someday he would be as powerful and respected as the judge. The heavy pack on his back made him think of what he would do when he got home. He would buy a new dress for his mother. He would buy toys for his brothers and sisters. And he would see the judge. In his mind, he saw himself entering the judge's office. He would count the money into the judge's hand. John could not wait to pay back the rest of the money that Judge Doan said his father had borrowed. By late afternoon, John's legs hurt, and the pack on his back was very heavy. He was glad when he finally reached the river, because that meant he was almost home. John remembered Seth's advice, but he was too tired to search for a place where the ice had melted. He saw a large, straight tree growing by the river. It was tall enough to reach the other side of the river. John took out his axe and cut down the tree. It fell, forming a bridge over the river. John gave the tree a kick, but it didn't move. He decided not to do what Seth had said. If he crossed the river on this tree, he would be home in an hour. He could see the judge that evening. With the furs on his back and his gun in his arms, he stepped out on the fallen tree. It felt solid as a rock under his feet. He was about halfway across the river when the tree trunk moved suddenly. John fell from it onto the ice. The ice broke, and John sank under the water. He did not have a chance even to yell. John dropped his gun. The furs and traps slipped off his back. He tried to grab them, but the swiftly flowing water carried them away. John broke through the ice and struggled to the riverbank. He had lost everything. He lay in the snow for a few moments. Then he got up, found a long stick, and walked up and down the riverbank. He poked through the ice for hours, looking for his furs, traps, and gun. Finally, he gave up. He walked straight to the judge's house. It was very late, but the judge was still in his office. John knocked and went in. Cold and still wet, John told the judge how he had ignored Seth's advice and what had happened. The judge said nothing until the boy was done. Then Judge Doan said, "Everybody has to learn things. It is bad luck for you and me that you had to learn like this. Go home, boy." John worked hard that summer planting corn and potatoes for his family. He also worked on other people's farms and saved enough money to pay the judge another $5. But he still owed him $30 from his father's debt and $75 for the traps and gun. Over $100. John felt he could never pay back the judge. In October, Judge Doan sent for him. "John," he said, "you owe me a lot of money. I think the best way I can get it is to give you another chance to hunt and trap this winter. Are you willing to go if I lend you another $75? John found the voice to say yes. He had to go into the woods alone that year because Seth had moved to another part of the country. But John remembered everything that his Indian friend had taught him. He stayed in Seth's cabin and hunted animals every day of that long, lonely winter. This time, he stayed until the end of April. By then, he had so many furs that he had to leave his traps behind. The ice over the river had melted when he reached it. He built a raft to take him across, even though it took him an extra day. When he got home, the judge helped him sell the furs for $300. John paid the judge the $150 he had borrowed to buy the traps and the guns. Then he slowly counted into the judge's hands the money that his father had borrowed. That summer, John worked on his family's farm. He also learned to read and write. Every winter, for the next 10 years, he hunted in the woods. He saved the money he earned from the furs. He used it, finally, to buy a large farm. From time to time, he would visit the judge in his big stone house. The old man no longer frightened him. By the time John was 30 years old, he had become one of the leaders of his town. When the judge died that year, he left John his big house and much of his money. He also left John a letter. John opened it and looked at the date. The judge had written it the same day that John had asked him for the money for his first hunting trip. "Dear John," the judge wrote, "I never loaned your father any money because I never trusted him. But I liked you the first time I saw you. I wanted to be sure you were not like your father, so I put you to the test. That is why I said you owed me $40. Good luck, John." Inside the envelope was $40.
You have heard the final part of the American story, Judge. Your storyteller was Harry Monroe. The story was written by Walter D. Edmonds and adapted for Special English by Donna DeSanctis. Harcourt Brace and Company published it in 1941 in Americans All, Stories of American Life, edited by Benjamin Heydrich. This story is copyrighted, all rights reserved. This is Shirley Griffith.